Yeah, you could talk about some of the trailers for the Super Bowl.
I didn't watch the Super Bowl.
Me neither.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me today is Keith Foster from San Diego, the whale's vagina.
How many episodes have I made it on without that reference being made?
Surprisingly a lot, but we did it.
All right. With me is the brain father of Jabber and the Drone, Cassidy Robinson from L.A.
And how have you been enjoying your rainy Southern Californian winter?
I'm ready for the sun to come back. Yeah, it's been, you know, rainy and gloomy. And mm-hmm. I mean, it feels shallow to complain about rain when California has been in a drought for like the last 6 years and everything. But yeah, I'm over it.
You're pretty over it. Yeah. Well, it only knows to rain when I have days off.
Yeah. It seems the same for me.
But I am famous now.
Are you?
I'm kind of famous. I'm sort of a big deal. And
I mean, you weren't in Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping.
I wasn't in that movie. But I did.
The reason I say that is because I was.
I know. We know. But I did have a producer send me an angry tweet because of a review I wrote.
What?
Yeah, I'm not going to mention names of the movie or the producer because I don't want drums. But
I feel like this podcast could use a little bit of drums.
Maybe
that would boost listenership.
We need a rivalry.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I wrote a review. So I had to review something. And I didn't I was waiting. I was in between paychecks and it was the end of the month. So I didn't know what I was going to see. So I ended up reviewing this movie that's been on Netflix for free for like a few months. It's not even a new movie. Okay. But it was a direct to Netflix thing. So it's kind of like, you know, a newish release. And sure. I sometimes cover Netflix originals. So I wrote this review kind of hastily and I sent it in and sort of forgot about it. And it was a terrible movie and I gave it a really bad review. And I did fuck all to promote the review. I didn't even put it on my blog because, like I said, the movie's not really new. I'll probably will at some point. And then the Idaho State Journal did very little to promote it either. I don't think they put it on their Twitter. They did, like, I had to, like, Google to see if it was put up anywhere because I was like, what the hell? Because I woke up one morning on Sunday, I got a tweeted message at me that said something to the effect of, like, a great film critic knows that there's other perspectives in the world other than his own. And so just like this shady ass tweet.
Wow.
And I was like, okay. So I click on the name because I didn't know who it was. And I saw that they had a website or whatever that connected them to the movie's website. And so I was like, what? That like just came out today and I haven't published it or anything. So yeah, I had to Google to see, and Idaho State Journal did publish the review online on their website. But yeah, the only way I could see that this producer was able to see the review is either A, he's Googling frantically every day to see if anyone's written anything about his movie.
Yeah.
Or B, he has some sort of algorithm thingy set up, a feed or something that just automatically puts any kind of stories about it into it.
Wow. See, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You should name it and then put it in the title of this episode and then like let's go to fucking Twitter war with this guy.
I really don't care that much. I tweeted back, I 100% agree. And now that was
might as well have just tweeted, my bad.
No, I think the intentions of it was supposed to be a little cattier than that. but yeah, I don't know. Amusing.
You'll have to tell me, like,
off air. I'll tell you off air.
I have a theory, but of what movie it is, but I don't want to say.
Okay. So what, did you do anything fun in the last week, the last 7 days since I've talked to you?
I mean, we had another episode of Tonight in San Diego, and that was fun. So we were filming a video segment for an upcoming guest on the show. That's sort of like this Lucha Libre wrestling group, but it's not Lucha mm-hmm. Libre. It's called the Ultimate Showdown, I think.
Okay.
And it's, they call it, oh shit, I had to like read the name and it was really, like I had to memorize what their tagline is. It's Planet Earth's only outer space video game super combat show, something like that. So it's like a luchador wrestling.
Okay.
Mixed with like WWE. But it's all like video game and sci-fi themed.
Mm-hmm. By the sounds of it, it sounds like almost like one of those weird Japanese variety shows.
I mean, it's sort of, but it's not like it's very like retro, and cool. It's just that all of their wrestlers have some kind of like superhero or video game theme to them.
Mm-hmm.
And like, they get superpowers, and like when you walk in, they act like it's, you know, being broadcast from space. It's very strange, but really fun. It was a really cool atmosphere, like 80s techno blasting in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like an ongoing storyline where like the championship belt gives people powers. And that was kind of what our segment is about, is like, we're interviewing them and then eventually we get powers, and they taught us like a couple of really easy wrestling moves. So we got to like beat up on their villains a little bit, me and Jesse Egan. Mm-hmm. So that was actually really fun.
Are you going to have a sizzle reel in like 5 years if you've done this show long enough, so where it's just going to be you doing weird things and dressed up in weird costumes? Like, here's Keith at the world's largest mud pit about to be swallowed by this fake crocodile.
Yeah, I mean, I've already want to put a sizzle reel together because I've done some cool stuff with the show. I fed tigers, man. I learned how to play polo. I did this weird wrestling thing. Like, I get to do some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, you're given some amount of access to, I guess, things that people would normally have to pay a lot to do.
Yeah.
And is that already aired? Is that online?
No, so it's like a little lead-in to, because the wrestlers are coming on the show as our guests, and mm-hmm. so it's going to be like a little lead-in video that we play when they come on the show, and I think they're not even going to be on the show till like March, well, so I can, you know, mention it again when it comes up.
When it happens.
Yeah.
So keep your eyes out for that, I guess.
Yeah.
Let's get into the movie news. We have a couple stories here. It's been kind of slim pickings during the awards season / festival season.
Mm-hmm.
Well, specifically Sundance. But I'm going to start with this one that we didn't cover last week, but I thought we might as well talk about it now. Netflix, speaking of Netflix originals, Netflix orders Green Room director Jeremy Saulnier for an Alaskan wildlife thriller called Hold the Dark. And it's an adaptation of a 2014 novel by William Giraldi.
Okay.
And though details are generally sparse, the film follows a wildlife naturalist who is summoned up to a remote Alaskan village to investigate a murder of a young boy by a rogue wolf. I don't know if they mean that, like an actual wolf.
Well, that's what it sounds like.
While he's there, he becomes involved in a dangerous triangle with the boy's grieving mother and unstable father. So, just in that, like, two sentences, there's a whole lot going on.
Yeah.
Green Room was a successful indie film last year. A lot of people liked it. I didn't so much, but it was Richard's favorite film of last year.
Yeah, I didn't see it, so I don't know.
But I did see his previous film. Well, I've seen Green Room as well, but I also saw his previous film, Blue Ruin, which I liked a great deal, and I liked enough that I'm still interested to see what Jeremy Saulnier does, especially in the realms of thrillers and this kind of stuff, because he's pretty good at it.
Yeah. I really have no frame of reference for this story, but I'm pretty into like Netflix.
You should see Blue Ruin. I mean, I get see Green Room because everybody in the world but me likes it.
His first movie was called Blue Ruin and his second movie was called Green Room?
Mm-hmm.
Is his third movie going to be like Red Rover?
I mean, maybe. If they decide to go with a different title.
I feel like...
They should, right? Like he has a thing going now.
Color thing.
Mm-hmm, like Kieslowski. And maybe the third one will bring them all together.
It's a very small niche of people that are into podcasts and into movies enough that are going to get that reference.
But they're going to love it.
I guess so. Yeah.
They just popped out of their chair when I mentioned Krzysztof Kieslowski's Color Trilogy.
That one's for you, Carl.
But yeah, I'm into it. Watch Blue Ruin. I think it's great. Watch Green Room, I guess. I didn't love it, but Richard did. So
see, I feel like I have to see Green Room just to like weigh in on it.
Just to be the tiebreaker?
Yeah, just to say who's right and who's wrong, because art is definitive.
Yes, definitely. Okay, what's going on here with the Slash Film article?
So this one isn't actually movie-related, but TV.
It is related a little bit to our Netflix homework.
Yeah.
Vaguely.
So NBC's Saturday Night Live is considering a Weekend Update spinoff. Apparently, the ratings for Saturday Night Live have been up. Apparently, the highest since, this article says, since the 94-95 season.
Wow.
And so they're considering doing some kind of weekday SNL Weekend Update show. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say who the host would be. I don't know if it would be Colin Jost and Michael Che. They're the ones who do it on SNL right now. It's pretty vague. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't even say this is a for sure thing. But, you know, it would kind of make sense because NBC kind of has a huge gap for, like, comedy content.
Mm-hmm.
Since 30 Rock went off the air.
Right. The Office has been off for a while and Parks and Rec, I think, is done now, right?
Yeah. They pretty much had a comedy vacuum since all of those have ended.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Like, isn't that kind of what Seth Meyers' show is?
Isn't that kind of what The Daily Show is? Like, yeah, when I first read the headline, I was like, yeah, that's called The Daily Show.
Sure, but... I mean, that's what inspired The Daily Show initially, was it was like, you know, fake news, tongue-in-cheek news, you know, tongue-in-cheek takes at real news stories that nobody cared about it. And then
it
slowly became a comedy take on real news and became more and more legitimate under the helm of Jon Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is NBC. And like I said, when Seth Meyers took over for Late Night,
He brought the Weekend Update vibe to it. That's how he approaches it.
Exactly. So I guess I just don't know what we'd be getting out of an SNL Weekend Update. I don't know. It's not really surprising to me that the ratings have spiked. We have a very controversial president, and we have a late night show that is not afraid to take shots at him. And... Mm-hmm. You know, he just makes their ratings better every time he tweets about it, which I'm surprised he hasn't figured that out yet since he's such a good businessman, but we're not going there. I mean, I don't know. I guess it's just a little weird to me, but I mean, sure, I'd be into it. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't watch SNL regularly enough to be able to say exactly. I watch whenever a skit does well enough to hit the wire. Then I'll end up seeing it like I saw Melissa McCarthy's Sean Spicer.
Yeah. You're a David Pumpkins SNL fan.
Yes, exactly. If it's big enough to like get published by all the different trade magazines, then I'll probably end up seeing it on my feed.
That's a shame, because I feel like SNL always, my favorite sketches are like the weird ones that mm-hmm. you'll never hear about. That was like a writer just pitched it and they're like, ah, we have 5 minutes to fill at the back end.
Well, that's kind of what David Pumpkins sure. was.
No, that was like...
that was a premiere sketch. That was like the front of the show.
Yeah, it was like second or third sketch, I think. It was near the top.
Oh, that's weird. Because to me, when I saw that, I was like, oh, surely this had to be after the update kind of time slot filler weirdness. Because I agree, back when I used to watch regularly, those were my favorite sketches. And the ones that I would end up remembering more so than the super topical ones.
Yeah. I mean, I like the topical ones, too. I just...
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely the weird, obscure... Nonsense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like SNL. Now that it's on Hulu and I have Hulu, I try to keep up with it.
You can watch pretty much whatever you want, SNL-wise, on NBC's website. They're pretty good. Like you can stream individual sketches or weekend updates there. You just don't get to watch it as a show. Like a
yeah, whole and I see. I like watching it as a whole show. It's but I mean, I get it. Like, you know, especially with the political atmosphere, it's nice to have people just, you know, savagely calling it out in a very funny way. I mean, the Melissa McCarthy sketch was great.
Yeah, really that funny. that was one of those like totally lived up to the hype kind of things. Like when I saw it, I was like, "Oh, this will be on a best of thing like 20 years from now."
Assuming, you know, NBC still exists and that America is a country 20 years from now.
Right.
If they haven't just burnt it all to the ground,
or that we have physical media anymore.
Yeah.
Which is even less likely. Okay, so that's the movie news. And let's go ahead and get into the review of this week, the main review, which is M. Night Shyamalan's new film, Split. And I guess I'll set this one up.
All right.
Three teenage girls are kidnapped by a man with multiple personalities, played by James McAvoy. Anya Taylor-Joy plays the main girl, who's kind of quiet and introverted, and she's sort of ostracized by the other two girls, and they don't all really know each other that well. And then when they get thrown into this, underground lair, that seems, you know, completely impenetrable. They have no idea where they are. They have no way to reach the outside world. They slowly begin to realize that, that McAvoy's character, presents to them several different personalities, and each of them, can, behave in wildly different ways. And they can manipulate some of the personalities, and they can't some of the others, and they don't know when he's going to switch between them. There's some other B plot and C plot stuff going on here, specifically with a psychologist who studies people with multiple personality disorders, who's in contact with McAvoy's character. She has no idea what he's doing with these women, but I guess the sort of dramatic tension there is, is she going to find out what's going on, and can she save these girls? Which reminded me a lot of the subplot of Misery. You remember that, where you had the small town police officer who's like reading the books by the author who's been kidnapped, and he's able to sort of figure out where they are through that. And it kind of creates a little bit of sort of dramatic tension there.
Yeah, I can see that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that might have been a small inspiration as far as that goes. I'm feeling a decent amount of Silence of the Lambs stuff coming through here.
Well, I also think that was intentional and, you know, definitely a plot device to kind of explain what's going on with McAvoy's character in a way that's not like, you know, to not just him like sitting down with the girl saying, well, I have 23 distinct person, you know, different personalities.
Yeah. No.
Like, I think that, I think it was kind of twofold. Like, it was meant to, I got a little bit of Silence of the Lambs reference there. I can see the Misery thing, although I didn't really think about it when I was watching it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's sort of M. Night Shyamalan's MO, though, is, you know,
right.
he is sort of to Stephen King's as J.J. Abrams is to Steven Spielberg.
Right. I would say that Shyamalan is a little bit of a Spielbergian disciple as well. Less so here.
Sure.
But I think some of his early films, especially like Sixth Sense and Unbreakable, definitely had those vibes. I think he's also, in maybe through proxy of both King and Spielberg, he's severely influenced by Alfred Hitchcock. And definitely here, I'm feeling a lot of Psycho. And I just rewatched Psycho, like, kind of on a whim. Like, it was just calling out to me. I kept seeing all these articles about Psycho and reading all these things about Psycho. And I was like, I guess I need to watch it again. And then when I went and saw this, it was like, this is just kind of Psycho squared.
Yeah.
But let's get into it. What did you think for initial impressions of Split?
I think Split is not only the name of the movie, but how I felt about it as well. There was stuff I liked. Yeah, like, I didn't think this was terrible. You know, I didn't think it was like a write-off joke movie that sort of has become associated with M. Night Shyamalan. A lot of people have been saying this movie's a return to form, and I agree with that, but I've always found him as a bit problematic as a writer and director. I think he could use with some like, he needs a producer. He needs like an editor who will come in and be like, yeah, this is a great concept. This is a great idea, but like, do we need to do this? Like, there were little things that kind of kept calling out to me. Like, why is it 23 distinct personalities when we only ever see 8 of them?
Right.
Or, or 9 of them. Like what is the reason for these other personalities when they literally serve no function to the story whatsoever? It, you know, like, could we get away with it just being 8? Which I think we could.
I mean, effectively it is. I don't even think it's 8. I think we see maybe 5.
We see little flashes of, let's see how many are credited. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are credited. And, and there's like, you know, like the, there's like an intellectual scholarly persona, which we only see very brief glimpses of, which, you know, but that's what I mean. Like, that should have been trimmed out of the script. It should be like, okay, what's the point of that? The doctor character was a little problematic for me too, because
I completely agree.
Yeah, I enjoyed the tension of when he would come to her office, like the first time he comes to her office, and it was a good way to kind of get some of that exposition out, but also a lot of it came out as a lot of exposition. Like, there's this also subplot of her like trying to get this study published. And there's this really awkward scene with her and another doctor where she's like, it's really clunky. There's like this scene where she's like Skyping in to teach this lecture.
Yeah. And she's literally lecturing to the audience, she's to the audience of the lecture hall, but specifically she's lecturing to the movie audience and just doling out the movie rules.
Yeah. I didn't need that. Some of the mythology, because it's not exactly multiple personality disorder. It's a made up disorder.
Yeah.
Which I think was necessary, because I think, you know, this movie could kind of come across as I know it's a horror film. I know horror films aren't meant to be nice and PC, but there are times when it comes across a little, I don't know what the word is for.
Insensitive?
Well, yeah. To mental disabilities. Like, it walks a fine line for me.
I'll say this in defense of the subject matter. I think the way that Shyamalan writes this mental disorder or the way that he approaches multiple personality is more in a literary slash pulp filmmaking way. I don't think that this is meant to be taken as anything like science.
Yes.
Especially by the time we get to the ending of the movie and it starts getting extremely high concept.
Yeah, so and straight up supernatural.
Right. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with his approach there. And I
am
some
to
parts
a
I actually point. Thought the movie would go more supernatural than it did. And then also there's this mirroring going on between him and the character played by Anya Taylor-Joy and what trauma looks like in the real world and what trauma looks like in the movie world. And I think that that's actually something that's fairly cleverly done and subtly done, which this movie almost does nothing subtle.
Yeah.
But I think that's the story beats that actually are played fairly gently.
Yes and no. Like, there's some weird sexual politics at work. Because, I felt a little conflicted with the fact that the two normal girls, air quotes normal, are just like totally useless and stupid. And I get that the movie's making a point out of that, but I feel like the movie played them a little too normal. And so it kind of came across a little condescending to me.
I didn't take them as being useless and stupid. At one point, one of them takes a lot of initiative to. She wanted to go with a different approach of how to get out. Like, let's just ransack him the next time he comes in, and we're going to do this. And she's like really kind of like immediately empowered.
All of her ideas are presented as flawed and
as
irrational,
and she
always gets caught, or she's told like, "No, that won't work. You're stupid," you know. And it's same with the kind of mental health. Like, it kind of toes a fine line for me because, there are some things that I think are a little insensitive, but. But because it's a made up movie universe with its own rules, I'll give them a little bit of credit. You know what I?
Yeah,
I just felt a little conflicted about some of those things.
Well, also, I mean, this is actually one of those kind of things. Like, if we were reviewing this with Richard, he'd probably have a lot to say about it because he went his background in psychology. But the little bit that I do know is that even traditional forms of multiple personality disorder is fairly controversial as a diagnosable actual thing. Like, there is some dispute in the world of psychology as to if it's even really a thing, because there's no way to test for it. There's no way to actually empirically look at how personality disorders function. It could just be people trying to get attention. And I think it came out, like, one of the most famous case studies, Sybil, she, like, came out later saying that she did make up the whole thing. And she got wrapped up in it because there was all – she kept getting press and she became so famous for it that she kind of had to keep going with it.
I don't know enough about it to say one way or the other.
Right.
And like I said, the movie does point out that this is a made up diagnosis. I mean, they're not like, this is a made up thing, but it has its own name. That psychologist character, her purpose is to sort of show us how it's, fictional. So,
right.
To me, and when it does become supernatural, I really liked that because the movie goes there. I was like, oh, holy shit. Okay.
Yeah.
And B, it's like, okay, this is a fantasy. This is a parable. This isn't, M. Night Shyamalan isn't taking a real stance on multiple personality disorder. He's just using that as a vehicle for his horror.
For his pulp ideas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a few specific things. I think the I'll get back into the criticisms later, but let's, what did we think of McAvoy? Because this is basically a show for him. This is, yeah. I mean, I think Anya Taylor-Joy does a lot of, does some really subtle good work in here as the, mm-hmm. as a center of consciousness. But I think, yeah, this, I think is all about, this is all about McAvoy and watching him play around in the sandbox. And this easily, like, if this had been, a worse movie, he could have come off really bad in this. If he had not been in stable hands. But I actually think he does, I was fairly impressed with what he has to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a, I mean, sort of the standard for one actor playing multiple characters is, I can't think of her name, from Orphan Black, Tatiana Maslany.
Mm-hmm.
Because she is so fucking good at, I mean, that's not multiple personality disorder, but she does play multiple characters. They're all clones, they look the same, but they all act very different, is so subtle. And James McAvoy is not as subtle.
No, this is a big, loud performance, for sure.
Yeah. And so, if she's the litmus test, I mean, I could watch James McAvoy read the phone book. I am a McAvoy fan. Okay. And I liked it. I was into it. I mean, all the characters are very distinct. He does have... there's moments where it's certain personalities pretending to be other personalities.
Which is interesting, yeah.
Yeah, which again is something that Tatiana Maslany's had to do in Orphan Black, and she does better. But again, that's not the point of this movie. It's meant to be bold and jarring, and it's sometimes scary and sometimes funny. And honestly, this was a blast to see with an audience, mm-hmm. because it got big laughs.
I think that's both this and The Visit, which was M. Night Shyamalan's last movie he did, which were the two that he's so far he's done with Jason Blum at Blumhouse. I think he's kind of entered a new era in his filmmaking, which is he doesn't have to be the kind of pseudo prestige, like he's becoming less and less Spielbergian, mm-hmm. and a little bit more kind of like sort of a down and dirty thriller maker now. Like he's working with smaller budgets, and he's isn't given a pass immediately anymore because he's had so many failures in a row that I think he knows, like, you know, if I want to be able to have a career, I have to be able to show that I can make an efficient thriller. And I didn't like The Visit that much. I do think that it got to the point a lot better, and it wasn't as bad as some of his previous films. But it was also bad in new ways. Whereas this movie, I think actually kind of cleans up a lot of those snags I had with The Visit and retains what I thought was okay about The Visit was this kind of black humor thing, this kind of dark humor sort of a mean streak that we've never seen in his previous work.
Well, yeah. And also, it was nice to see a movie where he let that is hinging on an actor's performance, because M. Night Shyamalan is not really known as an actor's director. Usually the acting is really subdued and kind of dull and boring, and usually the least interesting part of his movies. So I liked seeing him just like get a charismatic actor and letting them off the leash.
Yeah.
I think it was effective. Like, Dennis was intimidating and scary. Hedwig was, you know, funny and sweet. I think it was effective, and I think they were played well. I think the movie did use a sense of humor really well to set up tension, later on, because, you know, once the final personality is revealed, it's, you know, pretty intense and thrilling.
And the effects that they used for that, I was really glad that they were not too effects driven. Like it looked,
yeah,
using that kind of Blumhouse model of less is more.
Yeah.
It's a fairly creepy imagery without having to like go full CGI or go, you know.
Yeah, because when they were describing this character,
I thought we were going to get Narfs again. Like, I really honestly thought like the third act of this was just going to go totally off the rails and we were going to get Narfs and
you yeah know. Well, because the mythology they set is pretty dense. Mm-hmm. they're talking about like the characters have the light and there's a chair in a room and there all these personalities exist in a place that we can't see, and one of them is a beast that will come and he has hair and claws, and I was like, okay. And then there's like this transformation and it's like, oh god, are we going there? But yeah, I thought that was actually pretty subdued and done to great effect.
Yeah, just otherworldly enough without it tipping off into absurdity.
Yeah, exactly. That was actually, what to me, one of the high points of the movie is once it decides to go full horror, it's like, oh shit, it is going there.
Yeah. Now, we'll get back to when you kind of hinted at it. M. Night Shyamalan has always and continues to have serious exposition problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of started around the village, like full force in Lady in the Water, and really continues through. And he's so bad at exposition, it kind of blows my mind. But like, because he's good in other ways, but it's like that one thing he just can't crack down. And the only way he can do it is to write in these clunky moments, yeah, where a character is talking to the camera directly, or a character is doing a video log, or a character is doing a speech, and so that he can just rail off pages of exposition.
It's like his movies are so high concept that, yeah, he feels like he has to like really make sure the audience is on the same page, and it's like, mm-hmm, you could leave some stuff for interpretation. That's okay. You can be subtle. And that's what I mean. Like, I think he could really benefit from a co-writer or just someone a little more efficient with editing. Because
mm-hmm,
this movie sort of frustrated me because I basically liked it. It was, you know, it was nice to see M. Night Shyamalan do something relevant again.
Mm-hmm. And something that holds your attention the whole time.
Yeah, and there was enough going on, there was enough tension, there was enough humor, there was enough entertainment that, you know, the movie had me sucked in.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just be these little pings that would take me out for a minute.
Yeah.
And that's what's even more frustrating is it's like, okay, you just gotta, those could have been smoothed out and this could have been really fucking good.
Yeah, I actually think there's a cleaner edit here. If we could get an hour and 40 instead of, and I think it's an hour 57, something like that. Mm-hmm. If we get an hour 40, cut out a lot of those scenes of exposition. I think you could almost cut out almost everything with that psychologist character minus one or two scenes.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Like, I liked her interaction with James McAvoy, but basically everything else
mm-hmm
wasn't necessary.
Right. I agree with that. And the Silence of the Lambs bits, we'll call them, with Anya Taylor-Joy's backstory. Yeah. I actually think this is, like, if I were to teach a film class or a screenwriting class or something like that, I would use this film as an example to show the difference between story and plot. Because mm-hmm everything going on with psychologist lady, Dr. Exposition, That's all plot.
Mm-hmm.
Everything going on with Anya Taylor-Joy's backstory, that's all story. Because that informs her emotional well-being and her personal arc to get to the end of the film. Now, I think that M. Night Shyamalan kind of fumbles the ending a little bit. I feel like they've announced that there might be a sequel. And I wonder if he was just having so much fun writing these characters. He's like, I think there was a natural conclusion that he kind of untangled and left an open ending that didn't need to be there.
Well, so That's what that was another thing that I felt like was a little insensitive towards her character and the other two girl characters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can we get into the spoiler bits?
Yeah, we can get into a spoiler zone.
Okay. Warning those listening who want to see Split and have not had it spoiled for them already, which is probably not likely. There be spoilers ahead. So it kind of bothered me that her character was defined by the sexual assault from her uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that makes her, like, relevant and real. And I think he depicts the sexual assault in a very tasteful way.
Mm-hmm.
And the backstory was icky and uncomfortable in a good way. But it's just like you said, when he like sees the scars because he happened to rip her shirt off.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you're saved. You're blessed because you're sexually assaulted. And we don't know if those scars are self-inflicted or from the uncle, but it's mm-hmm. like, okay. Like, that's what I mean when I'm talking about the sexual politics. Like that's a little weird.
That was weird. Yeah. It's almost that she, is a martyr to her own abuse.
Yeah, and that these other
girls... And that she's become sort of deified or pure, or become... he literally calls her pure.
Yeah.
I agree with you. That conclusion, that final showdown between the two, the way that concludes, I felt like... To me, actually, I think that was... Given that the movie is so kind of lean and mean and dark up to that mm-hmm. point, I think that was actually his Spielbergian tendencies, and it kind of slips into sentimentality in a way that's actually he doesn't realize is so problematic and kind of fucked up.
Like I said, especially in the relationship to the other characters, because he did draw this clear line in the sand that
mm-hmm.
she is going to be saved because of this sexual abuse. But the fact that they, these other girls presumably never went through something like that, means that they're victims. Like,
right.
It's
weird. It's for sure weird. There's like a Laura Mulvey paper to write on the sexual politics of this movie, for sure.
And there's also like the weird thing with Dennis, where it's like at first they make it seem like he's gonna rape the girls,
mm-hmm.
but then again through some handy exposition, Dr. Psychologist reveals that it's okay, he just likes to watch them strip naked.
Which is still weird.
If you're
gonna go there, I guess.
Yeah, do we really need to make this character relatable? Because there is, like, a point near the end where she's literally justifying his existence, and you do almost, he's not the Beast, so, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
like, okay, do we really, why are we sugarcoating this when everything else in the movie goes for it? So that was also a little problematic to me.
Then...
We had the tease for the M. Night Shyamalan-verse. How did you feel about that?
Maybe I missed that, because I'm not going to lie. The last, 15 minutes of the movie, I had to pee so bad. so bad that when it hit, the end credits, I knew there was some postscript stuff, but I was like, I don't care. I'm done.
What?
And I had to go. Like, I'm telling you, man. Like, it was bad.
So this was, like... So I kind of had this spoiled for me, which is unfortunate. It is the next in a long line of M. Night Shyamalan twists that have been spoiled for me.
Okay. I guess the last scene that I saw in the movie was that McAvoy is kind of inspecting himself in the mirror, and he's like, oh, cool, I can live through this. I can live through being shot by bullets. So now I'm going to go out and kill people again or whatever. And then that kind of ends on that note. And there was some, newsreel stuff that was happening, but that's... I had to go.
You literally walked out right before the big reveal. So there's the news footage happening in the diner, and then it pans over to these two girls talking. Again, a very exposition heavy. And one of them is like, well, this is, wow, that's so weird. This is like that thing that happened with that that guy like 16 years ago. What was his name? And then the camera pans over a little more, and there's Bruce Willis. And he says his name was Mr. Glass. So there's a direct connection to
Unbreakable.
Split and Unbreakable, which even if you look at their posters, you can see that connection. But yeah, so.
Oh man, I did walk out right at the wrong time.
You missed it. Which I thought was, I'm not going to lie, I'm pretty excited. Like,
well, it is basically the origin of a supervillain.
Yeah. And, you know, Unbreakable, when it came out, was his comment on superheroes, mm-hmm. which, you know, at the time was like when there were just the X-Men movies. And you know, so it makes sense to me that he would venture into kind of the world building that Marvel has done and stuff. So
yeah, I mean, here's the thing though. I kind of want to see the Bruce Willis versus McAvoy movie. I don't want to see anything else.
Like, no.
I don't want there to be a big Shyamalan universe because I think he struggles enough pulling together one movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think he has the chops to be able to
tie them
to be
all
able to handle a movie universe, but he does have the ego.
Yeah, that's true.
And it would feed his ego in all the wrong ways.
That's true. Like to see him try to go full Stephen King and like connect mm-hmm. everything.
Yeah.
I don't know. From the articles I've read, it sounds like. So that's the supposed sequel you're hearing about. It's a crossover sequel between Split and Unbreakable.
And I think he could maybe pull that off. Again, I worry only because it's him.
Yeah.
And I at this point, I don't want him to bite off more than he can chew. He's just barely beginning to redeem himself.
Exactly.
And I think he should move from efficient little thriller to efficient little thriller until he's learned all the right lessons. But if he takes, you know, one step too far, he could definitely jump off the ledge.
Yeah. So we'll see what the future holds for Unbreakable Split, which also sounds like it could be a bullying movie.
Okay, so final consensus, the way I feel about Split is we're grading it on two different curves. We're great on the Shyamalan curve. It's like a B plus, yeah, something sure. like that. So it's at least the best movie he's done since The Village, which was a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's saying a lot. But if we're grading it against all supernatural-ish kind of thrillers, psycho thrillers, mm-hmm. It's like a C minus, like, or maybe a C. I enjoyed a lot of it, mm-hmm. But it is quite goofy. And a little too clunky to be able to recommend without reservation.
I would recommend it. I'd recommend it
in like a rent it from Netflix kind of, or watch it on Netflix or rent it from Redbox kind of way. But it won like three weekends in a row.
Yeah, I think it's good if you're not into like super intense horror. Like mm-hmm. I think it was an effective thriller. I think it's a, you know, it's an effective popcorn movie.
Yes.
I liked it. I liked
it more than I didn't like it.
Yeah, exactly. On the Shyamalan scale, I liked it better than some of his earlier movies, even just because there was this like sense of character and fun that I think a lot of his earlier stuff is totally missing.
It's not as stoic, yeah.
Yeah, and so I think I probably enjoyed it more than some of his other stuff. But I will admit that it's not necessarily as good.
as like Unbreakable or Sixth Sense or whatever.
Well, I think Unbreakable is him at his highest, and Sixth Sense I've always had a weird relationship with, because I knew the twist going into it, and I think that sort of ruined it forever for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's a movie that totally is defined by its twist. And I feel it, I don't know, I haven't watched it in a long time, but I felt like it was pretty,
it ruined it for you.
Yeah, pretty much there wasn't a lot for me to enjoy once I knew it. To me, that movie lives and dies by its twist. Mm. Whereas like Unbreakable, I think is a solid movie, regardless, And that's what I liked about this movie. It didn't hinge on some twist.
No, in fact, it kind of like, besides the postscript twist, which I missed in the bathroom, there's a few, some of the reason why the ending is so clunky. He kind of tries to force things into being a reveal that don't need to be a reveal.
Yeah.
Like what the location is when they were like, oh, look. And I was like, okay. Yeah. Like you could have revealed that in somewhere in the middle. It wouldn't have changed the movie.
Yeah.
Like, so true. It's like, that doesn't need to be a twist. You think at this point in his career, you just want to like walk away from that association, but I don't know.
I think I
liked it more than I didn't.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I think it's worth seeing.
Let's go ahead and talk about the Netflix homework, which you assigned me last week. What is it called?
National Lampoon, Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant Dead, the story of the National Lampoon.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a documentary chronicling the history of the National Lampoon magazine. It was a publication that started in the 70s and looks like went till about 2010, I guess. And it's that's it.
It kind of parlays into the National Lampoon's movies, obviously, which became bigger in the late 70s and early 80s, mm-hmm. and sort of its reputation as a whole. And I think most specifically with the argument that the movie's making is that it was sort of this ground zero for everything in North American comedy that we know today.
Yeah.
And it was the single-celled organism that kind of became the comedy genus that we kind of take for granted.
That's certainly the argument they're making. And I think for the most part, that's fairly accurate, but
at least in terms of modern comedy,
there's other stuff at work there, but yeah, I mean, National Lampoon is the thing that put it on a national stage.
What were the names of the two creators who started the Harvard Lampoon and broke it out?
Henry Beard.
Was it Doug Kennedy?
Yeah, Doug Kenny. Anyway, so it's I mean, that's it. That's the story. It's this magazine. It eventually they went into records and radio. Then they made movies, and then it stopped.
Yeah, or fractured into several other media entities.
Yeah.
Was this the inside baseball comedy extravaganza you were hoping it would be?
Yes and no. So I think the movie itself was done pretty well. Like I liked, it was a very clean documentary. It looks very nice because, they have animations from that they make out of old cartoons from the magazine. Mm-hmm. There are these, sort of fun transitions using the magazine. But I felt like as a whole, it was kind of a shallow documentary. Like, it just kind of goes from like, yeah, these are all these writers we hired. We did a bunch of cocaine, then we made a movie. Like I wanted it to be a little more kind of behind the scenes, but it literally is just chronicling the story of the publication. And like a lot of times I didn't even know who these writers were or things like that. And, I wanted it to be a little more behind the music kind of thing.
I think it tries to be a little warts and all. I mean, it doesn't necessarily show all of these guys in the best light all the time. It points out when they were being jerks or when they were being dictatorial with the staff or when people would get hired or fired and that kind of stuff. So there's a little bit of, like, behind-the-scenes drama. But, yeah, I agree with you. The overall takeaway from it, I think the biggest takeaway from it is here's this thing, because we kind of think it's easy to take National Lampoon's for granted now because we're like, ugh, they just make those direct-to-DVD movies, and I guess there was a magazine once. Vacation's still good. Like, basically, the brand of National Lampoon has kind of lost its luster in the last 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so many other things have kind of taken that from it. But I think, like Mad Magazine or like Cracked or any of those other kind of contemporaries, I found it interesting to see, like, oh, okay, so, like, you know, the Radio Hour ended up being where basically the entire first season or first few seasons of SNL came from.
Yeah.
And we obviously know the legacy of Saturday Night Live and what that's done. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think National Lampoon's doesn't get enough credit for really shaping the comic sensibility of that show.
I guess I just wanted them to go into it a little more. Like, when they mentioned Saturday Night Live, they're just like, yeah, they stole all our cast. And that's, like, it.
In and of itself could have been the documentary. If they decided to focus their story and use that as the linchpin of the, you know, the dramatic arc, being the rise and fall of National Lampoon's and then the continual rise and the ascension of Saturday Night Live, that could have been an angle to tackle that they only kind of use as a transitory period in the film.
That's kind of what I felt about the whole movie, mm-hmm. was like I felt like each thing was just sort of glossed over. Like, they're talking about hiring all these writers and you know, how great they were, but it doesn't really give us a sense of who any of them are or their comedic sensibilities or, like, what their direct influences were. I mean, mm-hmm. or who they influenced themselves. Like, I mean, it kind of shows you, because, like I said, it has, like, these little cartoons, or it shows, like, the title of an article, and it's kind of funny, but they don't, I guess I wanted it to get a little more in the weeds, like, mm-hmm. like, okay, well, what did this writer have a specific style? You know, like, was this the guy who made fun of religion? Or was this the guy who did all the sex articles? And, like, they kind of did that, but it felt so just sort of glossed over and self-celebratory.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think this movie was 100% written and directed for boomers,
sure.
who lived through that era and who already know all the references and who are already there. And I think to the detriment of the movie, it's kind of a nostalgia piece.
Yeah. And I think that's what frustrates me about it is like you said, I don't think that National Lampoon necessarily got enough credit as, you know, in comedy history, mm-hmm. but this movie's not really doing it any favors because it's not really going into it. It's just mm-hmm. like, yeah, we had this magazine and it was cool and it was funny and everybody liked it. And then we did cocaine. Like, that's what I felt was the whole movie, was just that story.
Yeah. And actually, I really kind of, like, had a hard time sympathizing with just about anybody in the movie. Because, I mean, yeah, they wanted to show it warts and all, and they use this kind of nostalgia as, like, oh, it was the 70s and everyone's crazy and woo. But the way they kind of paint everybody is just, like, so entitled and so, like, just, you know, not to get into an intergenerational rant, but just is, like, everything I hate about the baby boomer generation of, like, oh, we went to fucking Harvard and then yeah. had all this money and just decided to start a counterculture magazine, I'm putting in huge air quotes. Mm-hmm. And then once we got enough money, we fucking bailed because who gives a fuck about the counterculture, and now it's the 80s and we're going to sell out. Like, that's basically everything I hate about that generation, or the so-called countercultural hippie movement.
Mm-hmm.
And it pretty much plays out exactly in this case study.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, I agree. I get wanted more like behind the scenes stories. And I know that that is partially just who I am and my background of knowledge. Cause like I've read, you know, behind the scenes SNL books, and I've read, you know, other behind the scenes comedy books and things like that. And I wanted more of their story. Cause I just, mm-hmm. I felt like the movie itself was pretty shallow. And so I was just kind of frustrated by it. It just felt sort of self-serving and, like you said, a little too nostalgic. I mean, you know, it was fun hearing like some of the radio bits they did and seeing some of the archival footage.
Yeah. Early footage of John Belushi and that kind of stuff is super interesting. And there's stuff to like here. I think even like some of the concepts that they came up with when they did decide to kind of stop for a moment and focus in on something, like the idea of like the college yearbook issue,
mm-hmm.
And the way that they would, there was all these kind of like little stories interweaving and stuff, which would eventually kind of become, it was a high school yearbook, and eventually kind of transform into their idea for Animal House, the movie.
Yeah, I wanted more of that, like, because mm-hmm. I agree, that's exactly what I mean, because that story was really cool, and I just wanted more stories like that, like, just sort of dissecting, not just talking about their humor, but showing us like specific examples, you mm-hmm. know, besides Animal House. Like, I kind of wanted them to talk a little bit more about, because they don't talk about the movies at all after Caddyshack.
No, at one point, they say so and so as an editor quit, and then we don't really talk about anything anymore. Like, there's, whoever the interview subject was at the time, they were like, yeah, and then that's pretty much the end of the story. And I was like, wait, that's like late 80s. That is not the end of the story. There's still a lot of stuff that's happened since then. And yeah, maybe it's embarrassing and you don't want to talk about it because none of it's very good. That's still part of the story.
Exactly. And that's what frustrated me, is it felt like they left stuff out. It felt like they glossed over stuff. But I mean, the movie itself, it looks nice. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the
it's watchable.
Yeah, I mean, as far as a documentary goes, it's got some really, great graphics and transitions and stuff. But that's, to me, those are, you know, very shallow surface level details. The story itself is pretty light, I thought.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it might be good enough to, if you don't know a lot about this already, or you're not a comedy aficionado or whatever, you might find enough of this interesting to want to look into it more. You might like, oh, well, let's go see if any of those things are archived at the library, or let's see if I can find a book that's maybe written about this. But I think at best it's a tease.
Yeah, exactly. I sort of felt like an hour and a half long trailer for the movie.
For a better documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Next week, we will be talking about Tom McCarthy's The Cobbler, starring Adam Sandler. yeah.
Okay.
We're going to do this. And it came out the same year that Tom McCarthy won an Oscar for Spotlight. So, keep that in mind while watching. And if anybody has anything else they want to say about the show or anything we talked about here, if you have any topics you want to weigh in on, you can email us at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, on Twitter at jabberpodcast. You can follow me at BC Cassidy. Where do they follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid. You can follow me on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Follow me on Facebook, Keith Foster. You can check me out on Tonight in San Diego. We are back filming Monday nights at the Jeffrey Theater in downtown San Diego at 7:30. Episodes air on the CW6 at 11 p.m. If you're
in the Southern California region.
Yes. If you're not, you can always check it out on tonightinsandiego.com or YouTube Tonight in San Diego.
And if you want to listen to the podcast, you can subscribe and listen at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. Our archives are at jabberonthedrone.podbean.com. You can read the movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I will publish the controversial movie that got me mad, got some producer mad at me, and you can guess which one it was. You can also read some of the content I provided for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And be sure to listen to the friends of the show, Rod and Denise. They just released their latest episode of The Listening Party, and Denise is still doing her mascot diaries, where she's interviewing famous, or sometimes not so famous, mascots in and around the area. I think she talked to the Keytar Bearer recently. And other friend of the show, Patrick, be sure to listen to his podcasts, Make Dad Read Comics, and Almost Educational. Almost Educational, he did a solo one recently where he compared the origin story of Vladimir Putin with Dr. Doom. And it was very interesting, actually. I learned a lot about both.
All right.
But that's it. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye. Bye. Hashtag give it a Gosling.